Right, let's make a start. I'm Neil Lazarus, for those of you who don't know me. I'm co-convening the module this year. The module has been running since the 1999-2000 academic year. I just arrived at Warwick from the US that year, and I convened the module then and taught it in collaboration with Steve Shapiro, who had also just arrived in the department then. And it's been taught every year since then, always up until now collaboratively. Steve and I taught it for a while, then Graham MacDonald and I taught it, and then more recently I've been teaching it with Nick Lawrence. I'll talk a little bit about why we think it's been good to do it collaboratively. Before this year though, Nick is so swamped with other commitments that he's unable to do more than appear as a guest lecturer a couple of times. We haven't decided yet whether he should lecture for the whole 50-minute period, because I mean, given that he's coming to as a favor, I thought perhaps that would be better. You should get a syllabus. I feel that the collaborative exercise is much the better, where each one of us will lecture for 25 minutes for each of the lectures. Partly because you get the chance to see two different takes on the material at once. Very often, where we might be in disagreement, for instance, over material, which is partly what interests us, I think, in the as far as where critical theory is concerned. But this year, as I was saying, Nick's commitments elsewhere are such that he can only appear intermittently in the form of a guest lecturer on some occasions, and probably will lecture for the whole hour when he is able to come. I'm certainly very thankful that he is doing this. It's purely voluntary of him to be doing it. So thank you very much, Nick. Also, he's an expert on things that I know rather little about, so it would be a bit sketchy if I had to do them by myself. Malachi McIntosh, who is a postdoctoral teaching fellow this year, will also be doing some lectures, and Malachi and I might try the collaborative lecture format. Of course, this also breaks up the tedium of having one person, namely me, talking for the whole hour. This is the largest number of students who have ever enrolled in the module, and this has to do, of course, with the fact that last year, after considerable struggle, we were able to push through a change in the curriculum so that students can now choose pathways through the undergraduate degree. And one of these pathways is the theory one, for which this module is a requirement. So I should thank you for choosing the theory pathway, those of you that have done that. All of us involved in the new system hope that it will enable you to tailor your undergraduate career to your own research interests as those develop. Remember though that you're the guinea pigs here, and so that we hope that you'll work with us to ensure that any glitches in the new system, of which there are bound to be some, are brought to our attention and worked out. Let us know if you're experiencing particular difficulties, confusion, although I'll say something more about this particular module and confusion in a minute. Let's start directly then with the syllabus. If you'd look at the aims and objectives section, the aim of the module, does everyone now have the syllabus? There's a pile back there. You can read this in detail yourself, but let me just refer you to the sentence. The aim of the module is to familiarize students with the general contours and parameters of contemporary critical theory and to introduce students to key concepts, methods, debates, and controversies in the field. Perhaps I could say something here about the history of theory with a capital T in the academy. If one goes back some 30, 35 years, say that there was nothing under the name of theory being taught in English departments at that time. I remember myself coming to the UK in the late 70s from South Africa and doing an MA, for the first time an MA in something which was then called Sociology of Literature at the University of Essex was introduced, and which followed some of the lines that we'll be developing ourselves. There was, of course, a lot of work that you would say was theoretical. There was a lot of work being done on existentialism, on phenomenology, on structuralism in linguistics and in anthropology. But in English departments, there was, in fact, a set of procedures or techniques which usually went under the name of practical criticism or literary criticism. Not theory as such. What then congealed, I suppose, as theory began in the late 70s and early 80s and followed a set of new developments in theories of ideology, of subjectivity, of psychoanalysis, work in Marxism that blossomed across a huge terrain and that moved out of the social science departments that it had tended to be in up until that point, if you consider philosophy also to be some kind of a social science, and began to take root in departments of literature, including comparative literature departments in the UK and the US. And in some sense, we are the heir to that development here. It's now pretty standard, I think, for people not only at the graduate level but at undergraduate level to have some conversance or to develop some familiarity with what is called theory, which is a tremendously incoherent concept. There's no particular object necessarily that is involved here, and this might be one of the first sources of confusion for you. The module is different from most other or many other modules in the curriculum in that what's studied in it doesn't itself form a distinct or discrete or even classifiable object. So I'll say more about the particular works that we're going to read, the syllabus, that is, in a moment. But let me say something first about the rationale for the module and the experience of taking it. It isn't a course in literary criticism. Please don't be under any illusions about this. We want to say that it will help you to read texts. Indeed, we believe that very strongly, that it will add things to the way in which you approach literature elsewhere in the curriculum. But it isn't a how to do literary criticism module. It'll certainly help, though, in your engagements with literary works. What it's designed to do is to facilitate critical thinking. Something that we hold particularly dear at the moment, above all at the moment, when the autonomy of universities itself is under dramatic threat. We want to end the module with a discussion of one development in literary theory, namely the question of world literature, but also a discussion of the university, and the university not simply as the idea of the university, which has a long history, that idea of the university. What kind of an institution is the university? What does it do? But very specifically, the university in the UK today, under dramatic threat, as you know, the introduction of fees, the gradual corporatization and privatization of education, the yoking of education much, much more closely to policy guidelines set by government. So one could say the narrow politicization of the academy, the rendering of the academy subordinate to the perceived needs of the state as defined by the ruling powers. And this challenges decisively the kind of work that has been done critically. In one sense, the task of the module, I think, would be to sort of say no to all of that, to encourage a kind of dissent, a kind of critical thinking, which will have the effect, I think, of cutting against any kind of dogma or orthodoxy or convention, and particularly against the logic of political common sense, as that tends to be deployed these days. We want to encourage you to question everything, including, in fact, this module itself, so that we're not, it isn't, although, of course, we have strong prejudices ourselves, the module will allow and encourage difference and dissenting thinking, even about itself, even about what we say. More specifically, we want you to ask questions that get down to the deep assumptions that underlie given positions or standpoints. So, for instance, the economistic, if you like, logic that seems to saturate everything, the metaphor of the market, the idea of competition, which we're all being hammered on the head by, so that for years we've been told that we have to be teaching not critical thinking, but transferable skills, for instance. You no doubt are under tremendous pressure because you know that having graduated with a very good degree from Warwick in English, you're going to struggle very hard to find a job, many of you. These sorts of questions, and the fact that that is the case is bad enough, as it were, but the lack of thought about why it should be the case is something that we want to get you to think about. That's not the only aspect that the module is going to develop, but it's just one particular realm in which obviously you have a strong investment yourself. We think this kind of questioning is part of what being at university entails. We think that particularly because the current rubric is going against that. Increasingly we've been told this is not what the university entails. What we ought to be teaching you is how to get jobs, how to market yourself in certain ways. And this module, and I suppose an English degree as a whole, very few people do English precisely with that idea of immediately going out and professing English, whatever that would be. Whereas if you do medicine or law, it's pretty obvious where you're going to go, or if you do commerce. But English doesn't tend to go in that direction. But also think about what the experience of being at a university itself involves. Here you are in the real world, but not in the real world, as your parents probably will tell you on numerous occasions. What are you really doing? Sleeping all the time, taking drugs, listening to music, that's it. That sense of this is the... And when you try to explain that in some sense the thinking has to take place in time, that when you're thinking you're not just idling, that reading is not doing nothing. These are the sorts of we value that those 3 years that you have. It's not very long, 3 years. All of you are at least halfway through that process pretty much. And in those 3 years, it's a time out from the real world, which is going to bring its shutters down quite quickly enough, thank you. And yet we would like you to be able to develop something that acts as a bulwark against that logic. So university is a certain kind of space, perhaps a certain kind of utopian space, both in the world and not in it. I know that many of you work while you're here, but that few of you work full time. So in that sense, that you're not bound in that narrow way that most people are by material concerns. And that brings a certain kind of freedom with it, and that freedom has to be thought about, is what we're suggesting. So the questions we want to encourage you to ask, or at least to think about, are normally those that are put aside. And precisely not asked. So that's why I'm emphasizing this idea of thinking not only against the grain, but in some way thinking the deep, going to the deepest assumptions all the time. So in asking those questions, you are, in general, not doing things, but stopping the process. We want you to sort of jam the machinery, arrest the process, pause to think even about the simplest sorts of things, including about the fact that here you are doing an English degree and therefore you read English. What's involved? Think how, if you step out of it for a moment, it is a tremendously counterintuitive process, hence the difficulties that you might find explaining this to your friends and so on. I'm reading English for 3 years, what's reading mean there? I'm reading critically, or I'm reading intently, and I'm looking, what is English? Because it turns out that, of course, many of the texts are not written in English. at all, or when is English, when isn't it, etc., etc. What kinds of books? Think of how a canon has already formed in your heads. For many of you, in fact, you could say it had already formed before you got here. All of us who teach here have this experience of Warwick students arriving as first years with this tremendous set of embarrassments around certain media or genre. You know, people will introduce melodrama or Mills and Boone or the detective novel and say, well, of course, I know it's not serious literature. Already something has happened there. You're making divisions, classifications. How do those come about? What is good literature? Where does it come from? What are the criteria of value? What's their history? Particularly when you look at certain authors, works, etc., who have had very checkered careers. Shelley, for instance, who was much disprivileged and undervalued for most of the late 19th century and most of the 20th, but is now regarded as one of the sort of champions of the greatest exponents of Romantic poetry. How does that happen, that an author goes into and out of popularity? How does it happen that some authors never seem to have a dip in their popularity? What's involved in the Shakespeare industry, for instance? So in our case, what is English literature? Why do we study the subject? What's the purpose of criticism or of critique? Who are we that we study it? What kind of place is this, Warwick? Or the university in general. Here we are in PS 128. Thank goodness I ran into Malachi, because I had assumed that PS was psychology, you see, and was about to head off there. But some other people may have had that. Physical sciences. In a university, a university being what? A notion of diversity within a specific place. This idea of sharing, in some sense, a place where devolved knowledges occur. So what's the history of these questions themselves? What's the history of the what's the history of the institutions in which those questions have been raised? Something about the experience of taking this module. Over the years, this is what students have reported back to us. The first reaction for many of you is going to be of disorientation. It's as though I remember a student saying to me in the States once that it was as though the rug had been pulled from under their feet, and what made it even worse was there was no floor. It was a bit disorienting. But particularly, I think the module isn't about anything. It doesn't lead anywhere. These are what often people think. It isn't like anything else I've taken so far. We don't know what you want. I don't know what's expected to me. I don't know what I'm reading or why. Expect to have those kinds of feelings. And what we urge you to do is stick with it. Be patient. You're going to leap from, you know, next week we're looking at two texts, one written in 1784 by Immanuel Kant, the great Prussian philosopher. Whose work is this is an easy essay to read and difficult to think, but it's Kant in general is not someone that one just dips into lightly, as it were. Jump forward 200 years to Michel Foucault's response to Kant's essay. Kant's essay is called What is Enlightenment? Foucault responds with his own essay. Foucault, who comes out of, it's difficult to know how to pigeonhole Foucault as a thinker. What is he exactly? Is he a historian of ideas? He writes on the prison system, on the history of the asylum. He writes on sexuality. He writes about philosophy pure. So it's difficult. He seems to straddle. He's done work in anthropology. He's done all of this sort of work. Next week, the week after that, we leap away from this towards a German social theorist, Jürgen Habermas, who writes about what he calls the public sphere, focusing particularly on the coffee house scene in London in the 18th century. And we're going to jump back and forth this way. We touch on modernism. We'll do some stuff on postmodernism. We'll be just jumping from one theorist to another week by week. What is it that organizes or unifies this material when it's not as though you're able to get any depth or any foothold, as it were, on this. We're reading Kant's four-page essay by Kant, a philosopher who many philosophers spend their entire lives plumbing the works of. And so, you know, we read four pages of his work. What can we possibly say about Kant in four pages? And, of course, we're not really interested in Kant. You're not going to go out and immediately rush up and say, oh, you know, I'm an expert on Kant now, I've read What is Enlightenment. It's a marginal text. It's written as an opinion piece. It's not one of his major works in his own mind, etc. We're reading the first 56 pages of Habermas's Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, Habermas being an author who starts writing in 1960 and has never stopped. There are 30 or 40 books. We're reading 56 pages of one written as his second doctoral dissertation in 1962. In Germany, you have to write two. That's a cruel and unusual punishment. You write a second dissertation to qualify you to teach. The sense of, we're not expecting you on the basis of your engagement with theorist A or theorist B to see yourselves as experts in this. We're picking and choosing. We're focusing on certain topics and certain concepts, certain debates, certain arguments. That's what we want you to come out of this. These arguments take time to develop over the term. Suddenly in week 8 you'll say, wait a minute, I see this text as being in opposition to one that I read in week 3. That's the point. So in week 3, you're just reading something for the first time. Where does it go in your filing system, your mind's filing system? And expect it not to go anywhere. You're going to read the opening chapters of Marx's Capital, and you're probably going to be wondering why. I mean, it's a critique of political economy. It obviously is something read by radical social theorists, political economists, usually not by literary scholars, although it's tremendously interesting for us. It's written as though it's a Gothic detective story for a start. You're not necessarily Marxists, and you're not necessarily economists with an interest in surplus value, etc. And yet we're going to make you read this. We're doing the same thing with Freud. And again, the same questions, the same objections could be made. That, you know, we're not interested in your being psychoanalysts necessarily, or having a deep knowledge of Freud or of psychoanalytic theory. So expect to be somehow pulled apart by what you read. Things are quite challenging. Often the readings, as in next week's one, is easy to read, and as I say, quite significant in what it says. So will start your thinking. Sometimes you'll read a text that's 20 pages long and will take you, 7 years to read because they're tremendously formidably dense and difficult. So the reading is not too much, but often it's quite hard. And we want you to read things intently, read them at least once before lectures, and then again, if you can, before seminar. Think about them. Think about what you don't understand. Allow yourself not to understand quite a lot of what is happening. Don't just throw up your hands and say, I have no idea what this is about. No idea is in some sense a cop-out. Of course you have some idea. And even if you could come to seminar and say, this is what I don't understand, the first sentence. I don't understand the first sentence here. Here's what it says. Here's the way I was trying to construe it, but as you can see, it goes nowhere. That's helpful. Always read everything through. Even if you lose the first paragraph, read the second paragraph. Second paragraph may help you with the first. These are not novels or poems, obviously, that you're reading, so that they will require a different reading strategy to some degree. But be patient then with what might seem to be the vagueness, the incoherence. Our experience, or students' experience in the past, is that at a certain point, sometime towards the end of the first term, actually, you'll, just in time to hand in your first essay, you'll get the gist of things and begin to understand both the sorts of things that we're doing and also to have a commitment to the module, to begin to say, that you're on this side of these debates as distinct from that side. And this is why you are, and you want to kind of develop those ideas further. So it is in fact a module rather than a series of unrelated readings, which is how you might think about it in the beginning. So let me emphasize then the indispensability of doing the reading in advance, and then again coming to seminar and participating actively. This module particularly has a sort of, there's a kind of intimidation effect at some level which you have to combat, that particularly if you it's hard to speak if you don't understand what's going on. It's hard to give yourself the courage to say, I've no idea, because you think that maybe you're going to look stupid in the eyes of your peers, maybe, or that you think you're just way off base. Being way off base is indeed part of the point here. Risk saying things that you think would be stupid, not least because your colleagues will love you for it and say, thank God somebody said that, exactly what I was thinking too. But it's only by discussing, and particularly by discussing what you don't get, that we as a group, in other words, in the seminar itself, but you know, me or Malachi, the people who are actually leading the seminars, can begin to see what's causing difficulties or where a certain reading is going. Each seminar, each year is different. So that sometimes a particular text just absolutely works for you, and sometimes it doesn't. And it's hard to know. Sometimes, in fact, we've responded, you know, this one really, everybody hated it this year. We take it off the module, and students independently come up to us and say, why did we have no, I don't know, Kristeva or Baudrillard or Jameson or whoever it is? And you know, they're reading in this particular theorist by themselves. I mean, it's things work for strange reasons in a module like this. So do try talking about it. I think it's important to move as quickly as you can from passive reading to a more active kind of engagement. So you'll start by your reading Kant next week. It's a snap. He doesn't say anything that you couldn't understand, as it were, immediately until you start thinking about it, and then you think it's a little more incoherent or more difficult than you had first thought. But move immediately from the sort of passive reading where you just read and forget, to a reading, which you do normally, don't you? You then read and underline sometimes, or you underscore, which is a kind of a discrimination taking place. You're saying to yourself, if you underline something, you're saying this matters in a text. The next question is the important one for us, is why does it matter? Does it matter to you? Does it matter, do you think it matters in the text? What would you say about that? Could you put in your own words why it matters? And I think an important exercise, if you want to do this, is actually to write a sentence yourself about why it matters, or a paragraph. So nothing big or long, nothing that you necessarily even share. But the sooner that you get to writing about these texts, because also the fact that they are written in this way and that we're only talking about them also creates a block for some students. When the first essay is due in week 10, students will say, I find it tremendously difficult to start writing. I've been thinking about these thoughts all the way through the term. But writing is harder. Partly because you start to write and you find yourself a slave to the theorist who you think is the most important, who has grabbed you the most. There are some thinkers in this module who are utterly seductive in this way. I think probably the most seductive in the first term are probably Marx himself and Benjamin. And Benjamin is so seductive that one sometimes dips into him and never gets out. But there are just these astounding ways of putting things in Benjamin, that you read him and you're immediately transported and sort of rush, float around the room ethereally for a while. And it's very hard to write about that, because you just as it were, all you want to do is to replicate what Benjamin has done. In term two, there are other theorists like this, I think Adorno particularly, who is a colleague and friend of Benjamin's, but Bourdieu later in the module. It's very difficult when you write about Bourdieu, who has his own vocabulary for everything. When you read him, it's horrible. And you think, oh God, this is the worst thing I've ever read. You know, why can't he write, etc. But then when you crack the system, it just becomes extraordinary, and you rush around being a Bourdieusian everywhere in your life, partly because he's theorizing everything in your life. And it's, that's very difficult, where you end up by just spouting Bourdieu's concepts or words and not being able to put them in your own language. So move, if you can, from passive reading to active reading to writing as quickly as possible, if you can. It isn't a matter of right or wrong. I think that's very important. There's hardly anything you could say in response to any of the texts that you're going to read that would be inappropriate or wrong. We're interested in process is what matters here. Presentation, intellectual capaciousness, imagination, generosity. Think generously. Try to argue against the theorists or against your colleagues as generously as possible. Imagine that they could be right. Imagine that they are right and you're wrong, and then try to argue against them. Conceding that you are right, what could then be said? And you see eventually that indicts them. You've construed them at their best and found them. I mean, don't just say, you know, Freud is obviously an idiot. He thinks women have penis envy. End of story. What's involved here? We will be reading this aspect of Freud as well. But attempt to think through these theorists. Be as generous as possible in your engagement with them, which is also a good way, of course, of arguing in seminar. Don't grandstand in seminars, even if you know everything. Don't don't try to crush your fellow students under the weight of your wisdom. Work with them. Let's make it a collaborative exercise in something. I mean, it is quite extraordinary, actually, if you think collaboratively of how things develop, aspects of things that you don't know that they do match things that you know and they don't. So think with the grain, that is, but also against the grain. Argue against yourself. Never stop when you've reached some sort of happy resolution. Always ask yourself the next question, which is, what would you do with that? How would you respond to a counter-argument there? In other words, have you understood what you're writing all the way through? So that's pretty much what I wanted to say. I'll go through the syllabus in a minute, but are there any questions at this point? You will realize suddenly you've made a dreadful mistake. You shouldn't have chosen the theory pathway after all. Nick, do you want to say something?
I can just, this feels weird because this is the first time in 7 years that I haven't.
Yeah, I know, it does feel weird.
Stood by Neil's side every year. And it seems kind of appropriate that we're in this physical sciences building. I feel like we should be donning these lab coats and putting on protective eyewear and lighting up the Bunsen burner. Getting all clinical. So there's a weird appropriateness about the displacement. I'll just reiterate what Neil said, and maybe just correct a couple things. One, I think it's not that the module is about nothing. That would make it like the Seinfeld of English modules. It's actually about an enormous amount, obviously. The trick, I think, is to both respect and appreciate the details and specificities of what that content is on a week-by-week basis, at the same time as seeing that the module is really a series of grapplings or approaches to a common cluster of concerns, of themes, if you like. I mean, it's no surprise, just by looking at the syllabus, and Neil will probably enlarge on this, to see that modernity is a key term for the first term of the module. And the culture will become an important meta-theme for the second term. What you want to try and do, wherever possible, is find ways in which these thinkers are converging, where they're approaching a common problematic and arriving at different ways of framing that problematic. Neil mentioned Walter Benjamin. One of his great aphorisms, I always think, is the one that goes, ideas are to objects as constellations are to stars. In other words, looking up at the night sky, you see a random mix of points of light. What is it about a constellation? There's no necessary relation between them. It's us, the viewer, who is making those connections. but the, independently, the stars don't mean anything as such to the viewer. It's in the arrangement, in the configuration, that they come to acquire a certain degree of meaning. Same applies to the readings on the module. You need to find the places where constellations happen. You know, concepts come together. Debates begin to make sense. And the other thing to emphasize is that routinely, every year in LCT, you will find yourself thinking, I am the only one here who's just completely clueless, and I'm risking my first by taking this module. In fact, last year I had the best LCT group I ever had, and you know, we got to be friendly. We used to go out to the Dirty Duck and run on and talk about, you know, Marx and as you do. But it was very funny because they would come up independently to me and they would say, you know, I was in serious trauma by November because I thought I just shot my first by taking this module. I'm gonna just completely nosedive on these essays. And then they turned out to get among their best marks on the module, and we're happy again. That's not the moral of the story. The moral of the story is that it's okay to feel afraid, but don't assume, as so many students do, that you are the clueless one and everybody else is cruising at altitude. It's not true. Everybody else is in the same situation, more or less, give or take, and it changes week by week.
Including the lecturers, one should say.
Yeah, absolutely. help us out here. Use that fear. use the knowledge that we're all in that sort of same boat. And as Neil says, be generous about your confusions. The very best seminar discussions happen when somebody begins by saying, I have no idea what this guy's talking about. This makes no sense to me whatsoever. Or I was with him until, you know, sentence number four, and then it just all went completely downhill for me. That's a great way of starting a discussion. What is it about that point? You know, why are you disoriented? You know, where does the confusion come from? And then things kick off. I mean, it's a little bit like the thing that I mentioned last year. It's a little bit like that Talking Head song. Does anybody know it? A Once in a Lifetime? Yeah? You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. You may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. You may find yourself living in a beautiful house with a beautiful spouse. And you may ask yourself, how did I get here? That's what the module is about. How did we all get here? It's a kind of prehistory of our moment. And it's precisely about dragging the rug out from under our collective feet, because we assume so much in order to get along in the kind of daily rhythms of the same as new that is our modern, postmodern, contemporary, late capitalist life. What is it about that grounding, that sort of set of assumptions that need scrutiny? All of the thinkers on this syllabus help us to address that question of what's grounding our sort of assumptions about what's ordinary, what's everyday, what's to be taken for granted. So the question, of course, is why do we take these things for granted? How did it come to be in that way? So hopefully by the end of the year you will find out why you're behind the wheel of that beautiful automobile. That's the goal.
Any questions or comments?
Now they're really, really terrified.
Okay. When we first thought about the module, there were two ways we could have gone. The one was to, in a sense, to be responsible to the emerging field of, or to what is called theory in literary studies, and to give you a couple of weeks, as it were, on each one of the different sort of movements or trends or developments, including the ones that we like and the ones that we don't like, etc. And we thought about this and decided not to go that route, and not least because these days, I would say, it's almost impossible. We've got something like, 17 weeks
in which to tackle this, and if there's too, it would be too much to cover, too much in the background. So large areas and hugely significant or important figures are simply being ignored by us. And there is a strong case for their inclusion. Each year we think about how we should include the theorists that we do include. What we decided to do is to work thematically or in terms of emerging nodes or concepts, debates that work well, arguments that theorists have had between themselves. Because actually arguments are wonderful ways of learning. When you read, you know, person A and person A is in disagreement with person B, you begin to get a sense of what's, of firstly what they each stand for, but also of what's at issue, what's at stake. Why it matters between them, and so we have tended just to approach a couple of key nodes or aspects that seem to touch on lots of things, and do let us bring in various theorists across a broad range. So the first one, which will structure pretty much all of the readings that we do in term one, is the category of as Nick was saying, of modernity. And this, of course, is a tremendously difficult notion because it might be associated with any number of things. We tend to see ourselves, obviously, as living in modern times or even in postmodern times. But if we ask ourselves the question of you know, when does the modern begin? For whom does it begin? Are there people for whom it does not begin? When it begins for others, etc. What are the contours of modernity? How is modernity anchored in some way? And we see that there are a number of ancillary concepts around. One is the one that we're going to look at next week, which is that idea of enlightenment. What is enlightenment? How does enlightenment bear on this question of the modern or of modernity? Other dimensions of this problem that emerge already for you, I'm sure, are the notion of modernism, particularly associated with forms of cultural production from, say, the late 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century onwards, that movement associated with so many of the great writers of the early 20th century, but the great painters, the great artists in general, musicians, etc. What's the relationship of modernism to modernity? To the modern. How would one theorize that relationship? Another big category then, which might be introduced, is that of capitalism, along with its cognates of urbanization, industrialization, etc. How does that filter into it? Is one of these the determinant and others the consequences? How would one talk about, you know, how would one come up with a schema in one's head that allowed one to talk about enlightenment, modernity, urbanization, capitalism, etc., modernism, those sorts of. So in some ways, the reading in the first term is to explore this problem. You can already see that one will end up with a position which will not be the same as anybody else's position, but also that you can immediately see that as long as your argument works, there is no right way to do this. You could come up with a schema that works for yourself, and it might disagree entirely with somebody else's, but perfectly plausible. There are so many ways into and out of this problem. In term two, we're looking at less sort of huge topics in a sense, or that we're giving them less space. Among them, I suppose, are the one that Nick mentioned, culture. Itself, culture, particularly in its relationship to literature, but also I think in relationship to experience. There are two major definitions of culture. One is the idea of culture is the restricted project, refined, the best that has been written and thought, as Matthew Arnold defined it at the end of the 19th century. So culture in the sense of elite or high or esteemed or consecrated culture. The other is the broad anthropological definition of culture as a whole way of life. So that one speaks, let's say, of Welsh culture, meaning not to isolate the specific high points, but in fact a whole way of life, urban culture. And how do those two terms come together? What's the history of their of their emergence, of their separation, or of their integration, if you like? What can we say about that? It links in with other categories that we want you to explore. Experience, I've mentioned, which is a very complicated concept. Subjectivity, another huge topic there, the idea of being a subject, of having a self. This idea of subjectivity will emerge for us. And of course, subjectivity is marked in various ways along axes, let's say, of sexual difference. Some of the readings we'll be focusing on will look at feminist theorists who are talking about sexual difference. But also in terms of its relationship to ideology. So the question of common sense, if you like. What's the relationship between subjectivity and common sense? If one says, if you ask to define your identity and you say something like, I'm English. What's involved in that? What is conveyed in that formulation? A language, a nation, the relationship of English to British, for instance, immediately something that might be thought through. So ideology, subjectivity, experience, consciousness, then, as one of these concepts. So that's one of the sets of themes, that interlocking sets of themes that we'll be looking at in term two. And obviously we'll draw on what you've already learned in term one about modernity. And then at the end of the module, we do have a couple of weeks in which we deal with some theorists who seem to fit everywhere and nowhere, if you like. It's hard to get to put them under a particular category. Raymond Williams is one such, although you could say that Williams has a great deal to say about experience, about culture, and so on and so forth. This is what he writes about. But we wanted to look at Williams's own work just on its own terms for 1 week. And Pierre Bourdieu is the other, who also has a particular way of approaching these problems. I mean, it's partly that they write in distinctive ways, and if you put them in with other theorists, something would get blocked. So we are looking at a couple of theorists who are there for their own sake, as it were. And then, as I mentioned, this set of debates that we want to look at around the university and around world literature. Two topics that are tremendously important at the moment. Nick and I and Malachi are actually all part of a research project here. We call ourselves the Warwick Research Collective, REC, which is we're hoping is a catchy title, but which is designed to come up with a new theory of world literature. And we've all been working on this topic for some years now. So it is something that's very much happening at the moment in literary studies, a new form of comparativism, etc. We wanted to talk about that. But also, as I've mentioned, the university as a particular site, but a particularly troubled place today where external pressures are so acutely on the university at the moment. So we wanted to look at some literature there. I should say that the syllabus I've handed out, the term one is accurate. Term two I will probably change some of the readings for the latter half, but I'll obviously distribute those ahead of time for you for term two. I think I failed to mention the new work being done around the questions of the environment, ecology, and so on, that are a very important part of contemporary thinking at the moment. There's 1 week in which we try to feature some of that material as well. So it's more of a, term two is more of a grab bag, if you like. Of term one is more structured by this idea of the modern or of modernity. Any questions so far? As I said, we do hope that the lectures obviously will be lectures. The seminars will be your space and your time. Please try and use the seminars. There'll be no seminars this week. For next week, the reading materials are available in reading packs. The first term's reading pack is in the office, department office. You can get it. They cost £10 each. So please get it and read next week's material. The Kant essay is 4 pages, and the Foucault is about 20. There's nothing, as it were, conceptually difficult, I think, about this material. It gets complicated when you start to think about it. which is what I hope will happen in the seminars next week. So please come with things to say next week in the seminars, but we'll have the lecture this time next week. Okay, thank you very much.